Young took the parchment from Drake and stared at it.
It's not to be signed in blood. What the hell is this yin-yang symbol with the pentagon and the apple? You're a fucking fake.
His lips curled tightly in against his teeth.
What do you mean?
Said George through a throat that was rapidly closing up.
I mean, you're not from the goddamn Illuminati,
said Jung.
Who the hell are you? Didn't you know that before I came here? That I'm not from the Illuminati?
Said George.
I'm not trying to fake anybody out. Honest, really. I thought you knew the people who sent me. I never said I was from the Illuminati.
Maldonado nodded, a slight smile bringing his face to life.
I know who he is. The people of the old Strega. The Sibyl of Sibyls. All hail the Scoria kid, right?
Hail Harris,
said George with a slight feeling of relief. Drake frowned.
Well, we seem to be at cross purposes. We were contacted by mail, then by telephone, then by messenger, by parties who made it quite clear that they knew all about our business with the Illuminati. Now, to the best of my knowledge, perhaps Don Frederico knows better, there is only one organization in the world that knows anything about the AISB, and that is the AISB itself.
George could tell he was lying. Maldonado raised a warning hand.
Wait. Up, everybody. To the bathroom.
Drake sighed.
Oh, Don Frederico. You and your tired notions of security. If my house isn't safe, we're all dead men as of this moment. And if the AISB is as good as it's said to be, an old trick like running water will be no obstacle to them. Let's conduct this discussion like civilized men, for God's sake, and not huddled around my shower stall.
There are times when dignity is suicide,
said Maldonado. He shrugged.
But I yield. I'll settle the question with you in hell if you're wrong.
I'm still in the dark,
said Richard Jung.
I don't know who this guy is or where he's from.
Look, Chinaman,
said Maldonado.
You know who the ancient illuminated seers of Bavaria are, right? Well, every organization has opposition, right? So do the Illuminati. Opposition that's like them. Religious, magical, spooky stuff. Not simply interested in becoming rich, as is our gentlemanly aim in life. Playing supernatural games. Capiche?
Jung looks skeptical.
You could be describing the Communist Party, the CIA, or the Vatican.
Superficial,
said Maldonado scornfully.
And upstarts compared with the AISB. Because the Bavarian Illuminati aren't Bavarians, you understand. It's just a recent name and manifestation for their order. Both the Illuminati and their opposition, which this guy represents, go back a long ways before Moscow, Washington, or Rome. A little imagination is called for to understand this, Chinaman. If the Illuminati are yang,
George said helpfully,
we're yin. The only solution is a yin revolution, dig?
I'm a graduate of Harvard Law School,
said Jung loftily,
and I do not dig it. What are you, a bunch of hippies?
We never made a deal with your bunch before,
said Maldonado.
They never had enough to offer us.
Robert Putney Drake said,
yes, but you'd like to, though, Don Frederico. Haven't you had a bellyful of the others? I know I have. I know where you're from now, George. And you people have been making giant strides in recent decades. I'm not surprised that you're able to tempt us. It's worth our lives, and we are supposedly the most secure men in the United States, to betray the Illuminati. But I understand you offer us statues from Atlantis. By now, they should be uncrated, and that there are more where these came from. Is that right, George?
Hank Bard had said nothing about that. But George was too worried about his own survival to quibble.
Yes,
he said.
There are more,
Drake said.
Whether we want to risk our lives by working with your people will depend on what we find when we examine the objet d'art you are offering. Don Frederico, being a highly qualified expert in antiquities, particularly in those antiquities which have been carefully kept outside the ken of conventional archaeological knowledge, will pronounce on the value of what you've brought. As a Sicilian, thoroughly versed in his heritage, Don Frederico is familiar with things Atlantean. The Sicilians are about the only extant people who do know about Atlantis. It is not generally realized that the Sicilians have the oldest continuous civilization on the face of the planet, with all due respects to the Chinese.
Drake nodded formally to Young.
I consider myself an American,
said Young.
Though my family knows a thing or two about Tibet that might surprise you, I'm sure,
said Drake.
Well, you shall advise as you are able. But the Sicilian heritage goes back thousands of years before Rome, as does their knowledge of Atlantis. There were a few things washed up on the shores of North Africa, a few things found by divers. It was enough to establish a tradition. If there were a museum of Atlantean arts, Don Frederico is one of the few people in the world qualified to be a curator.
In other words,
said Maldonado with a ghastly smile,
those statues better be authentic, kid, because I will know if they are not. They are,
said George.
I saw them picked up off the bottom of the ocean myself.
That's impossible, said Young.
Let's look,
said Drake. He stood up and placed the palm of his hand flat against an oak panel, which immediately slid to one side, revealing a winding metal staircase. Drake, leading the way, the four of them descended what seemed to George 5 stories to a door with a combination lock. Drake opened the door and they passed through a series of other chambers, ending up in a large underground garage. The golden Appel truck was there, and beside it the 4 statues, freed of their crates. There was no one in the room.
Where did everybody go?
Said Young.
They're Sicilians,
said Drake.
They saw these and were afraid. They did the job of uncrating them and left.
His face and Maldonado's wore a look of awe. Young's craggy features bore an irritated, puzzled frown.
I'm beginning to feel that I've been left out of a lot,
he said.
Later,
said Maldonado. He took a small jeweler's glass out of his pocket and approached the nearest statue.
This is where they got the idea for the Greek god Pan,
he said.
Well, you can see the idea was more complicated 20,000 years ago than 2,000.
Fixing the jeweler's glass in his eye, he began a careful inspection of a glittering hoof. At the end of an hour, Maldonado, with the help of a ladder, had gone over each of the 4 statues from bottom to top with fanatical care and had questioned George about the manner of their seizure, as well as what little he knew of their history. He put his jeweler's glass away, turned to Drake, and nodded.
You've got the 4 most valuable pieces of art in the world.
Drake nodded.
I surmised as much. Worth more than all the gold in all the Spanish treasure ships there ever were. If I had not been dosed with a hallucinogenic drug,
said Richard Young,
I gather you are all saying these statues come from Atlantis. I'll take your word for it that they're solid gold, and that means there's a lot of gold there. The value of the matter is not worth 1/10,000th. The value of the form,
said Drake.
That I don't see,
said Young.
What is the value of Atlantean art if no reputable authority anywhere in the world believes in Atlantis?
Maldonado smiled.
There are a few people in the world who know that Atlantis existed, and who know there is such a thing as Atlantean art. And believe me, Richard, those few got enough money to make it worth anyone's while who has a piece from the bottom of the sea. Any one of these statues could buy a middle-sized country.
Drake clapped his hands with an air of authority.
I'm satisfied if Don Frederico is satisfied, for these and for 4 more like them. Or the equivalent, if 4 such statues simply don't exist. My hand is joined with the hand of the Discordian movement. Let us go back upstairs and sign the papers, in pen and ink. And then, George, we would like you to be our guest at dinner.
George didn't know if he had the authority to promise 4 more statues, and he was certain that total openness was the only safe approach with these men. As they were climbing the stairs, he said to Drake, who was above him,
I wasn't authorized by the man who sent me to promise anything more, and I don't believe he has any more at the moment, unless he has a collection of his own. I know these 4 statues are the only ones he captured on this trip.
Drake let out a small fart. An incredible thing, it seemed to George, for the leader of all organized crime in the United States to do.
Excuse me,
he said.
The exertion of these stairs is too much for me. Would love to put in an elevator, but that wouldn't be as secure. One of these days my heart will give out going up and down those stairs.
The fart smelled moderately bad, and George was glad when he had climbed out of its neighborhood. He was surprised that a man of Drake's importance would acknowledge that he farted. Perhaps that kind of straightforwardness was a factor in Drake's success. George doubted that Maldonado would admit to a fart. The Don was too devious. He was not your earthy sort of Latin. He was paper thin and paper pale, like a Tuscan aristocrat of attenuated bloodline. They re-entered Drake's office, and Drake and Maldonado each signed the parchment scroll. After the phrase, for valuable consideration received, Drake inserted the words, and considerations of equal value yet to come. He smiled at George.
Since you can't guarantee the additional objects, I'll expect to hear from your boss within 24 hours after you leave here. This whole deal is contingent upon the additional payment from you.
Orgasm. Her boobies fritched by the gurning deep sea doodler. All in a ludicrous chaste for a malting a forkin. In fact, hearing Drake say that he was to be leaving the syndicate fortress made George feel a bit better. He signed in behalf of the Discordians, and Jung signed as a witness. Drake said,
You understand there is no way the organizations which Don Frederico and I represent can be bound by anything we sign. What we agree to here is to use our influence with our many esteemed colleagues and to hope that they will grant us the favor of cooperation in the mutual enterprise.
Maldonado said,
I couldn't have said it better myself. We, of course, personally pledge our lives and our honor to further your purposes.
Robert Putney Drake took a cigar out of a silver humidor. Slapping George on the back, he shoved the cigar into his mouth.
You know, you're the first hippie I've ever done business with. I suppose you'd like to have some marijuana. I don't keep any around the house. As you probably know, we don't deal much in the stuff. Too bulky to transport, considering the amount you can make on it. Aside from that, I think you'll like the food and drink here. We have a big dinner and some entertainment.
The dinner was Steak Diane, and it was served to the 4 men at a long table in a dining room hung with large old paintings. They were waited on by a series of beautiful young women, and George wondered where the gang leaders kept their wives and mistresses. In some sort of purdah, perhaps. There was something Arabic about this whole setup. During the main course, a blonde in a long white gown, which left one breast bare, played the harp in a corner of the room and sang. There was conversation with the coffee. 4 young women sat down briefly with the men and regaled them with witticisms and funny stories. With the brandy came Tarantella Serpentine. She was an amazingly tall woman, at least 6'2", with long blonde hair that was piled high on her head and fell below her shoulders. She was wearing tinkling gold bracelets around her wrists and ankles, and there were diaphanous veils wrapped around her slender body. And nothing else. George could see pink nipples and dark crotch hair. When she strode through the door, Banana Nose Maldonado wiped his mouth with his napkin and began applauding gleefully. Robert Putney Drake smiled proudly, and Richard Jung swallowed hard. George just stared.
"The star of our little rural retreat,"
said Drake by way of introduction.
"May I present Miss Tarantella Serpentine?"
Maldonado's applause continued, and George wondered if he should join in. Music, oriental but with a touch of rock, flooded the room. The sound reproduction equipment was excellent, nigh perfect. Tarantella Serpentine began to dance. It was a strange hybrid sort of dance, a synthesis of belly dancing, go-go, and modern ballet. George licked his lips, and he felt his face get warm, and his penis begin to throb and swell as he watched. Tarantella Serpentine's dance was even more sensuous than the dance Stella Maris had done when he was being initiated into the Discordian movement. After she had done three dances, Tarantella bowed and left.
"You must be tired, George,"
said Drake, resting his hand on George's shoulder. Suddenly, George realised he had been going on almost no sleep, except for the times he dozed off in the car on the way from Mad Dog to the Gulf. He had been under incredible physical and, even more important, emotional pressure. He agreed that he was tired, and praying that he would not be murdered in his sleep, he let Drake lead him to a bedroom. The bed was an enormous four-poster with a cloth of gold canopy. Naked, George slid between cool, crisp sheets, and clutching the top sheet around his neck, lay flat on his back, shut his eyes tight and sighed. That morning he had been on a beach in the Gulf of Mexico, watching naked Mavis masturbate. He had fucked an apple. He'd been to Atlantis. And now he was lying on a downy soft mattress in the home of the chief of all organized crime in America. If he closed his eyes, he might find himself back in the Mad Dog jail. He shook his head. There was nothing to fear. He heard the bedroom door open. There was nothing to fear. To prove it, he kept his eyes closed. He heard a board squeak. Squeaky boards in this place? Sure, to warn the sleeper that there was someone sneaking up on him. He opened his eyes. Tarantella Serpentine was standing over the bed.
"Bobby Baby sent me,"
she said. George closed his eyes again.
"Sweetheart,"
he said,
"you are beautiful. You really are. You're beautiful. Make yourself comfortable."
She reached down and turned on a bedside lamp. She was wearing a gold metallic bikini top with a short matching skirt. Her breasts were delightfully small, George thought. Although on a 5'2" girl, they'd be ample. But Tarantella was built like a Vogue model. George liked her looks. He'd always been partial to tall, slender, boyish women.
"I'm not intruding on you, am I?"
she asked.
"You sure you wouldn't rather sleep?" "Well, it's not so much what I'd rather do,"
said George.
"I doubt that I can do anything other than sleep. I've had a very trying day."
Masturbated once, he thought, had one blowjob and fuck one apple. Forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. Plus been scared out of my wits 90% of the time. Tarantella said,
"My name is known in ratified circles for what I can achieve with men whose days are all trying. Presidents, kings, syndicate heads. Naturally, rock stars, oil billionaires, people like that. My thing is, I can make men come over and over and over and over again. 10 times, sometimes even 20 times, no matter how old or how tired. I get paid a lot. Tonight, Bobby Baby is paying for my services, and I'm to service you, which I like very much, because most of my clientele is on the middle-aged side, and you're nice and young and have a firm body."
She gently pulled the sheet loose from George's grip. He'd forgotten he was still holding it up around his neck, and caressed his bare shoulder.
How old are you, George? 22?
23,
said George.
But I don't want to disappoint you. I'm willing and I'm interested. In fact, I'm curious about what you do, but I'm pretty tired.
Honey, you can't disappoint me. The more limp you are, the more I like it. The more of a challenge you are to me. Let me show you my speciality.
Tarantella doffed her bra, skirt and panties quickly, but deliberately enough to let George enjoy watching her. Smiling at him, she stood before him, her legs spread, wide apart. Her fingernails tickled her nipples, and George watched them swell up. Then her left hand, playing with her left breast, her right hand snaked down to her groin and began massaging the golden brown hairs of her mons. Her middle finger disappeared between her legs. After a few moments, a scarlet flush spread over her face, neck and chest. Her body arched backward, and she gave a single agonized cry. Her skin from head to toe was glowing with a fine coating of sweat. After a momentary pause, she smiled and looked at him. Her right hand caressed his cheek, and he felt the wetness on his face and smelled the lobster Newberg aroma of young cunt. Her fingers drifted to the sheets, and with a sudden movement, she stripped them away from George's body. She grinned down at his stiff cock, and in a moment was on top of him, holding his prick, inserting it into herself. 2 minutes of smooth, piston-like movements on her part brought him to an unexpectedly pleasant orgasm.
"Baby,"
he said,
"you could wake the dead."
He enjoyed his second orgasm about a half-hour later, and his third a half-hour after that. The second time, Tarantella lay on her back and George lay on top of her, and the third time she was on her stomach and he was straddling her from the rear. There was something about the mood Tarantella created that was crucial to what she called her speciality. Though she had boasted about her ability to make a man come repeatedly, when it came right down to doing things, she made him feel that it didn't really matter what happened with him. She was fun-loving, playful, carefree. He did not feel obligated in any sense to stiffen, to come. Tarantella might view men as a challenge, but she made it clear that George was not to see her as a challenge. After a short nap, he woke to find her sucking his rapidly hardening penis. It took much longer this time for him to come, but he enjoyed every second of mounting pleasure. After that, they lay side by side and talked for a while. Then Tarantella went to the bedside table and took a tube of petroleum jelly out of a drawer. She began applying it to his penis, which grew erect during the process. Then she rolled over and presented him with her rosy asshole. It was the first time George had had a woman that way, and he came rather quickly after insertion from the novelty and excitement of it all. They slept for a while, and he awoke to find her masturbating him. Her fingers were very clever and seemed quickly to find their way to all the most sensitive parts of his penis, with special attention to that area just behind the crown of the head. He opened his eyes wide, and he came, and saw, after a few seconds, a small, pale, pearl-like drop of semen appear on the end of his dick. A wonder there was any at all. It was getting to be a trip. His ego went away somewhere, and he was all body, letting it all happen. It was fucking Tarantella, and it was coming, and judging by the sounds she was making and the wetness in which his penis was sloshing, she was coming too. There followed two more blowjobs. Then Tarantella pulled something that looked like an electric razor out of the bed table drawer. She plugged it into the wall and began to stroke his penis with its vibrating head, pausing every so often to lick and lubricate the areas she was working on. George closed his eyes and rolled his hips from side to side as he felt yet another orgasm coming on. From a great distance, he heard Tarantella Serpentine say,
"My greatness lies in the life I can generate in limp pricks."
George's pelvis began to pump up and down. It was really going to be that super orgasm Hemingway described. It began to happen. It was pure electricity. No juice. All energy pouring out like lightning through the magic wand at the centre of his being. He wouldn't be surprised to discover that his balls and cock were disintegrating into whirling electrons. He screamed, and behind his tight-clenched eyes he saw very clearly the smiling face of Mavis. He awoke in the dark, and his instinctive groping motion told him that Tarantella was gone. Instead, Mavis, in a white doctor's smock, stood at the foot of the bed, watching him with large, bright eyes. The darkened Drake bedroom had turned into a hospital ward and was suddenly brightly lit.
"How did you get here?"
he blurted.
"I mean, how did I get here?"
"Sal," she said kindly, "it's almost all over. You've come through it."
And suddenly he realized that he felt not 23, but 63 years old.
"You've won," he admitted. "I'm no longer sure who I am."
"You've won,"
Mavis contradicted.
"You've gone through ego loss, and now you're beginning to discover who you really are. Poor old Saul."
He examined his hands. Old man's. Wrinkled. Goodman's hands.
"There are two forms of ego loss,"
Mavis went on,
"and the Illuminati are masters of both. One is schizophrenia, the other is illumination. They set you on the first track, and we switched you to the other. You had a time bomb in your head, but we defused it."
Malik's apartment, the Playboy Club, the submarine, and all the other past lives and lost years.
"By God,"
Saul Goodman cried.
"I've got it. I am Saul Goodman, but I am all the other people, too."
"And all time is this time,"
Mavis added softly. Saul sat upright, tears gleaming in his eyes.
"I've killed men. I've sent them to the electric chair 17 times. 17 suicides. The savages who cut off fingers or toes or ears for their gods are more sensible. We cut off whole egos, thinking they are not ourselves, but separate. Oh, God, God, God."
And he burst into sobs. Mavis rushed forward and held him, cradling his head to her breast.
"Let it out,"
she said.
"Let it all out. It's not true unless it makes you laugh. But you don't understand until it makes you weep."
Queens. Psychoanalysts in living cells, moving in military ordure, and a shitty outlook on life and sex, dancing queens in Harry's Krishna. It all coheres, even if you approach it bass-ackwards, it coheres.
"Gruad the Greyface,"
Saul screamed, weeping, beating his fist against the pillow as Mavis held his head, stroked his hair.
"Gruad the Damned, and I have been his servant, his puppet, sacrificing myself on his electric altars as burnt offerings."
Mavis cooed in his ear.
"Yes. Yes, we must learn to give up our sacrifices, not our joys. They have taught us to give up everything except our sacrifices, and those are what we must give up. We must sacrifice our sacrifices."
"The Greyface, the life-hater,"
Saul shrieked.
"The bastard motherfucker, Osiris Quetzalcoatl, I know him under all his aliases. Greyface, Greyface, Greyface. I know his wars and his prisons, the young boys he shafts up the ass, the George Dorns he tries to turn into killers like himself. And I have served him all my life. I have sacrificed men on his bloody pyramid."
"Let it out,"
Mavis repeated, holding the old man's trembling body.
"Let it all out, baby."
"No, Thung. Woden, you know it. When you heard those flying sheeps with Wagner's loopy howls, Hassan walked this loony valley. He had to wake up by himself.
August the 23rd, 1966. Before he ever heard of the SSS, the Discordians, the Germs, or the Illuminati, stoned and beatific, Simon Moon is browsing in a consumer discount store on North Clark Street, digging the colours, not really intending to buy anything. He stops in a freeze, mesmerised by a sign above the time clock. No employee may, under any circumstances, punch the time card for any other employee. Any deviation will result in termination. The MGT.
God's pajamas,
Simon mutters, incredulous.
Pajamas? Aisle 7.
A clerk says helpfully.
Yes, thanks.
Simon speaks very distinctly, edging away, hiding his high. God's pajamas and spats, he thinks, in a half-illuminated trance. Either I'm more stoned than I think, or that sign is absolutely the whole clue to how the show runs. Rags. Hail Gulumbia. Her monard men are fled, and all she's left now is a bloody period.
The funny part,
so said, smiling, while a few tears still flowed,
is that I'm not ashamed of this. 2 days ago I would have rather died than be seen weeping, especially by a woman. Yes,
Mavis said.
Especially by a woman. That's it, isn't it?
Sol gasped.
That's their whole gimmick. I couldn't see you without seeing a woman. I couldn't see that editor Jackson without seeing a Negro. I couldn't see anybody without seeing the attached label and classification. That's how they keep us apart,
Mavis said gently.
And that's how they train us to keep our masks on. Love was the hardest bond for them to smash. So they had to create patriarchy, male supremacy, and all that crap, and the masculine protest and penis envy in women came in as a result. So even lovers couldn't look at one another without seeing a separate category. Oh, my God, my God,
Saul moaned, beginning to weep heavily again.
A rag, a bone, a hank of hair. Oh, my God. And you were with them.
He cried suddenly, raising his head.
You're a former Illuminatus. That's why you're so important to Hagbard's plan, and that's why you have that tattoo. I was one of the five who run the U.S.
Mavis nodded.
One of the insiders, as Robert Welch calls them. I've been replaced now by Atlanta Hope, the leader of God's Lightning. I've got it, I've got it,
Sol said, laughing.
I looked every way but the right way before. He's inside the Pentagon. That's why they built it in that shape, so he couldn't escape. The Aztecs, the Nazis, and now us. Yes,
Mavis said grimly.
That's why 30,000 Americans disappear every year without trace, and their cases end up in the unsolved files. He has to be fed. A man, though naked, may be in rags,
Sol quoted.
Ambrose Bierce knew about it. And Arthur Machen,
Mavis added.
And Lovecraft. But they had to write in code. Even so, Lovecraft went too far, mentioning the Necronomicon by name. And that's why he died so suddenly when he was only 47. And his literary executor, August Derleth, was persuaded to insert a note in every edition of Lovecraft's works, claiming that the Necronomicon doesn't exist and was just part of Lovecraft's fantasy.
Sol asked.
And the dolls? Real,
Mavis said.
All real. That's what causes bad acid trips and schizophrenia. Psychic contact with them when the ego wall breaks. That's where the Illuminati was sending you, when we raided their fake Playboy Club and short-circuited the process. Du Hexen Hasse,
Sol quoted, and he began to tremble.
Unheimlich. Vater, whose art's uneven, horrid be thine aim. harpoons in him, corpus whalum. Take ye and hate.